Good afternoon. This is Joseph Childs. I'm sitting here with Brent Childs and Philothea Beeson, and this is Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM, radio from the Driftless area of Western Wisconsin. You can find us online at wdrt.org, where you can find archival episodes, and this show airs the last Saturday of each month. So I'd like to introduce my guest here today. Brent Childs is a lifelong farmer from Crawford County, dairy farmer, avid gardener, and most importantly, he is my father. So this should be a really special interview. I'm also sitting here with Philothea Beeson, the host of Who's in the Kitchen, which airs on WDRT. So today we're looking to discuss the history of farming in Crawford County and the surrounding areas, and how new farmers can get into the farming industry these days. So I'll try not to say dad too much, but it's a hard habit to break. So, Brent, when did you start farming, and what was farming like when you first started?
Oh, my dad was a farmer. I grew up on a farm, and I was born in 1964, so I guess that's when it all started. And things have really changed in farming. I mean, from lots of farms to hardly any anymore.
I don't know. What was the first farming experience that you can remember?
Chasing calves.
And that was a dairy farm?
Yes.
So what was the size of the farm that you were raised on, or the farms that you were raised on?
Oh, they usually run between 160 to 200 acres. We milked around 70 cows. We always had pigs too, chickens, you know. And we grew a big garden. We had a big family.
And were those farms that you owned?
No, we rented. Usually 50-50 or 60-40.
Do you mean like a percentage, like you would?
Right, yeah. We get, the people would, we'd rent the land, and then we'd furnish the labor for half the milk check, or half of whatever profits come off the farm.
That's interesting, because we don't really think of it that way now. And I know a lot of other trades, they have apprenticeship style, you know, learning if you're going to be an electrician or a plumber or a welder. Oftentimes you do an apprenticeship where you study under someone for a few years, and then you become a journeyman, and then you eventually become a master, which a master farmer is something a bit of an oxymoron. There's something that you've always told me growing up is, if the day you stop learning is usually the day that you're dead. So as a farmer, you really never ascend to that master title. So talking about renting farmland, that's what I do with my custom grazing business, and I did that as pretty much a way to get into farming, because it's really hard to afford farmland nowadays, especially good farmland. And if you can afford the land, you can usually not afford to buy the equipment or the cattle to farm it. So the first memories that I really have of, you know, realizing that farming was going to be something that I wanted to do for the rest of my life was on a farm owned by Larry Dobbs over by Ferryville. And I wanted to speak with you a little bit about that farm. From my recollection, the stuff that we sold off that farm was the milk. There wasn't, you know, we weren't selling a lot of crops. We sell bull calf here and there, but we did raise a lot of crops, and I wanted to ask you about that. You know, we would raise some corn silage, raise some hay silage, some ear corn, and that all went into producing the milk. So that's something we don't really see much anymore, where farmers are raising their own inputs. A lot of times it's bought in from other people. Do you see that as a sustainable way to operate a farm nowadays, to grow all your own inputs and feed your herd to produce your milk?
Yes. It's not just your farming, is you're losing kids to it, you know, because as a small farmer, I don't put that. it's just hard for young people to get into it, and not a lot of people want to get into it because they don't understand it. Like, they don't, you know, you throw a seed in the ground, and they don't know what's coming out of it. They don't know what to do with it.
So what does it take to produce milk? What does it take to produce a dairy product as far as the inputs for the cattle? Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh, you got to love animals. You got to love long hours. I don't know now if it's sustainable to have a small farm. It just, unless it's been handed to you, you might make it work. And you don't want to get rich. I don't know how to really answer your question.
So, talking specifically about, you know, the feed that we had, the feed that we would give our cattle, we raise that on the farm. We didn't buy that, so we were able to keep input costs low. Like you said, you're not really going to get rich doing it, but we were able to produce what we needed to feed our cattle. And instead of having to pay someone with large, expensive machinery who needs to cover their overhead, and eventually it gets to the point where the cost of production of milk is higher than what you're selling your milk for. Can you speak a little bit on that, of how it's changed from, you know, producing everything that you need on your own farm instead of buying it in? Do you know of any farmers that are still producing everything that they need to produce their milk?
No, I don't. Not right offhand. My experience with my dad was that he never sprayed corn. We always cultivated. We had two teams of horses. I mean, everything was low-key, low expense. We never had big machinery. You know, it was the most. But Dad bought a 560. I think he gave $3,500 for it. It was our biggest tractor.
The Farmall 560.
Yep.
And what horsepower would that have compared to nowadays?
Oh, it had about 50, maybe 50, 45, 50.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back to that topic of what you grew for your cattle. I mean, I'm not sure if everybody knows what the crops you would need. You would put in some corn, like it sounded like you put in corn.
Yeah.
And then you'd have a grain of some sort, and then the hayland, or what?
Yeah, just that's Dad always raised oats, corn, and hay.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't know what a round baler was till after I left Dad. Yeah, we always...
Well, that really changed things.
Yeah.
Going from the square bales.
Yeah, our skidster was a pitchfork and a wheelbarrow. And, it was... But we had lots of kids running around, you know, mm-hmm. which was...
So then what kind of machinery would you have to have? If you're growing corn, then you need a planter.
Planter.
And what do you need to harvest corn?
Corn picker.
Picker.
Corn picker. And then how do you make silage?
We didn't make
silage.
No.
You didn't make silage.
Yeah, and then, it was all square baled hay and crib corn.
Mm-hmm. And then for the oats, you need a seeder or something.
Yep. Grain drill. Yep.
And then to harvest it, you need what?
Combine.
That's what we ran into. Yeah. We had to get ourselves a combine when we tried to grow grain, and that could be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
We didn't want a very big one. They were more rare, yeah. little combines.
Little ones, yeah, that's what we had.
But would you own those, or would you also have them custom done or
no,
rent machinery?
We owned them.
You owned
them. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that's a tractor and like four implements already, and then you have the hay-making equipment, which would be?
A baler, wagons, mower.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about an investment, you've got the land, which is just getting really expensive. And then you have the animals.
Right.
You have to buy the animals. Yeah. But a lot of farmers would start with a small herd and then breed them, right, and raise their own calves, and then that would be their herd. And then you have the machinery. And what other expenses would you have? Well, I guess if you're going to have any kind of fertilizer, I don't know, sprays or whatever, I mean, that all adds up. And seed, you have to buy seed. So then farmers would save their seed, right? Was that one of the ideas, is to grow?
Prior to the commercialization of, of our seeds, yes.
So saving your seed, I mean, that was something that I got into on Who's in the Kitchen, I mean. Saving seed, and then now running into companies that don't allow you to save your seed because it's patented.
End up in federal court doing that.
So it gets a little complicated, but I was sorry to, you know, interrupt, but I'm just really interested in you know, fleshing out some of these ideas. And I know when you were talking about, you know, when these kids come out and they're young and they really don't know anything about farming, that's us. We really didn't. We didn't know how to keep down the weeds in corn. And I see weeds in corn are a big problem. You can cultivate only so far, right? And then the weeds take over.
Yeah.
So, you know, the advent of herbicides to kill the weeds, that sounded pretty appealing, right?
Yeah.
To a farmer.
It was definitely appealing. It would save you time and... Imagine at the beginning it would save you some money of running your tractor or paying someone to come and cultivate. But eventually you become, I wouldn't say addicted, but you become used to just doing that, and you pay the higher prices, and weeds get to the point where they are, you know, they evolve very rapidly when it comes to herbicide resistance, and pests become pesticide resistant. So you have higher and higher doses and different, you know, more and more potent chemicals to kill off these weeds. And even to this day, you can hear any farmer at a local gas station complaining about water hemp. That's something that has become Roundup resistant. And there's every year it seems that there's another weed that's Roundup resistant. So they tweak the formula and make it more powerful and then sell you the next best thing. And it all comes back to the commercialization and kind of the industrialization of our farming. And I have written down here, you know, what was the most common farm size when you were growing up?
About 160 acres, not much more than that.
And why was that?
I think it's the way they you know, what's the word I want to learn? That's just how they scaled the property or the land, you know. When you come in, you know, back in the 30s or 40s, it's parcels were 160 acres or 80 acres or 40 acres.
And you couldn't really run, you know, if we were running horses or small tractors, you couldn't really run 800 acres in a year.
Oh, God, no.
So it's just kind of the human scale of operating a farm.
We've gotten better and better at building stuff that can, you know, run large acreage, and that's when the farm started getting bigger and bigger, and because we could run it.
So I had a neighbor, and he was so proud that he farmed his land with just a farm all A. So that's all I needed. Well, that's a really, how many horsepower is that? I mean, that's a small tractor. And he was very proud of that, and I think he had 80 acres. But, of course, a lot of times around here, not all of that acreage is tillable. I mean, we have a lot of woods and hills and stuff.
If you get out into, you know, the plain states, you're looking at massive, massive machinery that can do, you know, 30, 40 rows at a time.
Okay, so I want to know, if you compare a farm where you have the machinery to grow all your own crops and then you feed your crops to your animals... And you kind of, like you were describing, Joseph, you kind of self-sustaining that way. Does it make more sense to buy your crops and not own all that machinery and just buy hay and just buy corn feed at the feed mill? Or how do you come out?
There's going to be some years where it would probably make more financial sense to do that. But I certainly wouldn't go and sell off all the machinery, because now you have to do that. If you have the machinery and you know, hay is super high one year, you can maybe sell off some of your hay and make some cash. But if you put all your hay ground into, know, corn and soy or annual crops, or and hay is super high, that you're now you're buying in hay. So you can, it would make sense in certain years, but looking at this past year, you know hay is $100 plus for a round bale. In some years it's 30 to 40. So you're kind of backing yourself into a corner there, where you're at the mercy of the markets, and that's, as any farmer knows, that's not a good place to be, especially when you're with farming with animals is a whole different thing than just farming the land, because you have a responsibility to those animals, and they're not going to wait a week or two for the prices to get better. They have to be fed, they have to be taken care of, they have to be bedded, they have to have bedding for them. So farming with animals, in my opinion, is really the kind of the pinnacle of farming, because that's the relationship that a farmer builds with the land is directly related to their relationship with their animals. And that that's why I'm a grazer. That's why I could not stand to sit behind the windshield of a tractor for more than an hour or two. And I've always loved dealing with animals, and I got that from my father. And that's kind of, when I think of a farmer, I think of a farm that has animals on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the crops were really something that you put in order to feed those animals.
Well, speaking of crops, what kind of feed, say, do dairy animals need? Do they need grains? Do they need corn? I mean, now we have a kind of a movement to just do grazing and really focus on grazing mostly for the animals. What is needed?
So I'll as far as dairy, I'd have to defer to my dad here on this one. But with beef, you can raise them much easier on grass because they're not having to produce a ton of milk.
Okay.
That grain and protein is really what helps the dairy animals produce good milk.
Oh, I see. I didn't really understand that.
Yep.
So the grass-fed, we're really talking more about beef farming.
There are grass-fed dairies now, and it takes a while to get that dialed in, because then you're really a grass farmer, because you have to make sure that you have good quality forage for your animals and good quality pasture, and they can produce some really good milk, but it's not for the faint of heart. You can't just go in and graze anything and expect to get a good output of milk. But I know we had, I think the only input we really bought in was soybean meal over at Larry's.
Yeah.
And other than that, we produced our own corn, ear corn, and I spent many an afternoon on a Saturday with my dad at the corn crib. I'd climb up in the corn crib and kick the ear corn down, and he would run the mix all, and we'd fill our own grain bins with ground corn. And that was an input that we raised and stockpiled for the year.
So how did you get the corn ground?
It's a mix-all. It just grinds it up like a big grinder.
You can do that at the mill?
Well, you can hook it to your own tractor.
You
don't have to. When I was a kid, Dad always hauled it to town. You'd have to shovel it onto the truck and then haul it to town. They'd put it in bags.
Haul
back home, haul the bags in.
Well, now soybeans, you see soybeans everywhere. I wonder who eats soybeans. What are they for?
They send most of them overseas.
Oh, China, for what?
China takes a lot of soybeans from us.
Oh, it's not really a crop to feed your livestock.
No. There's some that gets fed here, and I imagine that's
as a what protein. China.
Yeah, as China's not... pork industry, I imagine, would use quite a bit of soy. Mm.
Interesting. Okay. Because they didn't use soybeans, grow soybeans that much when you were farming,
no.
Brent?
No.
So that's actually an export crop, huh?
It's a cash crop. Actually, they use a lot of them in the States, but here in the last, I'd say, last 25 years, they've got to be a protein mix. Everybody wants to put mixes and everything and to produce milk. Well, what you do there is you lose the quality of your health of your cattle, because we grazed all while we were farmers, is when my dad was, and you can just see the difference. Cattle don't last as long. Their health isn't as good, you know. And then you got 800 cattle in one building. That's taking, say, 8 farmers out of it. You know, it's just one place. Mm-hmm. Instead of having a small farm, you got.
So with a small farm, would your cattle be, they come in to get milked and then they go outside or out into a loafing shed or something like that?
Outside. We mm-hmm. had day pasture, night pasture. Yeah, our cows, just in the winter, but we still turned them out for quite a bit in the winter, uh-huh. you know.
So now with when they have these really, you know, 800 cows or I don't know how many, 600 cows...
Where
are the cattle? Are they moving around? Are they?
They're generally in a freestyle barn yeah. where they have sand, sand or straw or some sort of bedding, and they can move around within a. It's a large, large shed basically, and they go in there and they spend all their time in there, and then they come in and get milked, and then they go back to the freestyle barn. They might travel, you know, a couple hundred yards.
Mm-hmm. So do they come in on their own? They come in when they feel like it? I mean, these newer farms? Or do you call them, or they have an order of lining up?
It depends. There's robotic farms. There's farms where they're in a parlor where you still have to have humans milking them. So it really depends on the okay. technology on that farm. And we can this is a great place to have a little station break here, and this is Joseph Childs. I'm sitting here with Philothea Beeson and my father, Brent Childs, who's a lifelong farmer in Crawford County, a dairy farmer. You're listening to Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM, radio from the Driftless area of western Wisconsin. If you like this episode and want to find some others, you can find us online at WDRT.org and find the archival episodes. And this show airs the last Saturday of each month. So I think that a good transition to talk about our next topic that I have written down here of grazing. So when we get to scales, you know, 5, 6, 800, 1,000 head of cattle, it's extremely difficult to find grazing land that is going to be able to efficiently make use of that. You know, with 40 head, you can put them out on a 40-acre pasture for a couple of days and bring them back in and milk them. But if you've got 800 head, that 40-acre pasture would be chewed down before breakfast time. So having enough land to graze and enough grazing, a good grazing pasture to handle all those cattle would be really just not feasible whatsoever. And I wanted, you know, the whole topic of grazing nowadays is really looked at as like this newfangled thing that it's, you know, it's the next best thing and it's, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. And really it's a millennia old technique of feeding your animals. It's really just, it's crazy what animals will do when you just let them be animals. They'll haul their own manure out to the pasture. They will go and feed themselves. There's no need to bring the feed to them. And I was speaking with my dad on the way up here that, you know, we had 4 different pastures that we would turn them out, and I never understood it when I was younger of, you know, why do I have to take them, you know, through the tube and across the road today, and in 2 days I'll be taking them to a different spot. I was like, this just doesn't make any sense to me.
You mean he did rotational grazing? Now it's a big thing, right?
Yeah, we didn't even, you know, we didn't think that was really anything special. It was just, well, the grass is eaten down over here, let's take them to a different place where the grass is taller. So that was something that my experience in the last couple of years, you know, digging a little bit deeper into the effects of grazing and the impact on the land has really made me appreciate, like, this is something that small-scale farmers were doing because it made financial sense. You know, it wasn't, I don't think, Dad, I don't think Larry and you and Mom were really like, you know, we're doing this to help save the world. It was, well, we don't have any food in the barn for them, so we're going to let them go out and find their own food. So one of the topics we want to talk about was how to get into farming nowadays for the younger generation, and we've touched a little bit on that apprenticeship style, you know, transition from the older generation to the next generation of farmers. And then grazing fits hand in hand with that. It's very, very low input, a little bit more labor intensive than just being able to drive up with a skid steer and feed them on a lot or something like that. But you don't have to own the skid steer. You don't have to own a tractor. You just have to have a good fence, some good water, and the ability to judge whether or not you should be grazing pasture that's an inch and a half tall. You know, that's not too much inputs you have to go through. And what I've found through my custom grazing business is that there are tons and tons of landowners that either they were farmers in the past, or maybe they moved out here from a different area to enjoy the beautiful driftless area scenery and natural resources, and they don't really understand what to do with their 40 or 50 or 80 acres. So there's a really big gap in, you know, there's lots of farmland out there that isn't being used that could be used, and it just takes a little bit of initiative from someone like myself and the younger generation that wants to start farming to approach these people and really get a huge, huge leg up on the competition when you don't have to own the property. Maybe you have to pay, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,000 a year for some really good pasture, and then find someone that's got cattle. These large dairy operations, oftentimes they have, you know, a couple hundred heifers that aren't quite ready to be milked. They need to feed them, so either they keep them at the farm and they feed them silage and the TMR mixed ration, which is total mixed ration. It's a Dad, if you want to, you're a little bit better at this, kind of explain what a TMR is.
It's a like you said, it's totally mixed ration, and it's you usually get with your feed dealership, and they give you a ration. It's probably a good thing for big dairies. It's because they've already got most of the feed, and it's, if you mix it, they digest it better. I'm not a real fan of it, but I guess it's labor, it saves on labor if you're totally mixing it. It's just one trip through, and that's, you know, and they mix everything in it, their minerals, or it's just a one-shot thing, you know.
To really just simplify, like a breakfast smoothie or a protein shake, it is something where you take all the stuff that these cattle need, and they do, you know, talk to their herd manager, and they get a ration from the feed mill, or, you know, or the agronomist, mm-hmm. and say, this is what your cattle need at this stage of life, and we mix it all together and you put it in front mm-hmm. of them. And it's very easy to do once you have the equipment to do it, but it costs money. So if you are able to, you know, these dairies say, well, I can sit here and feed them stuff that's costing money, or maybe I can get someone to take them and put them on pasture because they're Maybe they're already artificially inseminated, and they're just waiting for that mm-hmm. heifer to have her calf so that she can be milked. There's tons and tons of heifers out there that could be grazed, and that's mm-hmm. where someone like myself would be able to approach these farms and say, you know, it would cost you less money to pay me to graze your animals, and then, you know, I can make some money. I don't have the overhead of owning all the cattle. And maybe I have to pay $1,000 for rent of pasture, but maybe I make $5,000 or $6,000 grazing the animals, and that takes away all of their labor for feeding them. It takes away their input cost for feeding them. So it's really a win-win-win when you talk about the landowners having animals grazing on their property, which will improve their property, and the grazer who wants to get into farming, he's making a little bit of money, he's getting some experience, he or she. And then the farmer is saving money in the long mm-hmm. run. So
I'm interested. I probably don't have enough acreage, but I have about, you know, 15 acres of hay land.
Yeah, so I've got a lot of pasture around Soldiers Grove and a couple closer to Viroqua. What I try to do is sit down with individual landowners and really discuss what their view of their property is mm-hmm. and what they want it to be in 5 years or want it to be in 10 years. And some of them are, you know, most of them are wildly different. Some people just want to have some animals there because it makes them feel good and they miss their, you know, growing up on the farm. Other people want tax breaks, so they just need to have some animals on the property. Some people have really, really brushy areas where they want some animals to come in and clear it out and restore that to a more diverse area. So it's really about sitting down with the property owner and seeing what they want for their property and then mm-hmm. finding cattle owners that don't want to feed their animals hay through the summer, especially during times where hay is $100 plus a bale. So that's how I got started, and I see that there's way too many people for just me. So I'm not gatekeeping the industry by any means. I'm absolutely advocating for more and more young people to get into farming like this.
Well, I think it's really great that that you are doing this, and there are people out there that kind of pairing up, you know, the people with land with the people that have animals to graze. I guess you'd have to look at your fencing situation. But you can really put up, you know, portable electric fencing now, pretty much. That's how people do it. I was thinking, how are my boundary fence? My boundary fences are okay, but then I'd have to put up electric fence if I wanted to.
As long as your boundary fences are okay, that's good. If they get out of the interior paddocks, that's fine, as long as they're not in the neighbor's petunias or out on the road getting hit.
Right. But boy, I can say that we had goats, and they clean out a lot of weeds. But the cattle really cleaned out a ravine that was just unmanageable, and now it's just a much nicer piece of property just because they got it all cleaned out. And I don't have any cattle now anymore, and I would really like to have a few, maybe heifers or little steers or something like that. So I'm interested, and I think especially when people are retiring and they have their land still, but they really can't farm it themselves. I think that's just a wonderful combination,
and that's kind of how. Well, I mean, that's exactly how I got started. Was most of the people that I talked to were older people that couldn't farm the land themselves, or could but they didn't want to anymore, and they didn't really need the money from it, but they just wanted to have a farm still. And that's for as many days as I really get frustrated with the animals that I have. There's many, many, many more days where I absolutely love it. And I'll sit and talk with my cows and my sheep and my single bottle goat named Gary. He was the first goat I've ever had, and he follows me around like a dog now.
they are precious. They really are.
But it's something that I think gets in you, and it's hard to get rid of that, if not impossible. And that's when we moved off the farm. We moved to Mount Zion, and we'd taken the equity that my dad and my mom had built within the herd and purchased a house in Mount Zion. And even then, I think it was, maybe a year, and Dad brought home some bottle calves, and we had 6/10 of an acre, and we were raising bottle calves, and we ended up finding some pasture to rent very close by, and, you know, no fences, no electricity, no water, but it was, you know, 15 acres of pasture. And I wanted to talk a little bit about why did we do that? Why didn't we just go and to the store and buy some beef?
I think a couple of reasons is to keep my sanity and to feed my family. I mean, it's hard to, when you got the knowledge to graze a garden or animals. I can't see going to the store if you don't have to, but. And I really enjoy animals, I guess, is the best way to put it. Mm-hmm.
I know my husband always used to sing to the, he always called them girls, and he sang to them when they came in to get milked. And I just thought, you know, it's just something special. I'd never farmed. I really didn't know what it was like, but.
Yeah, I can remember, I don't know if it was a milk inspector or something came to the farm over by Ferryville, and he was a young guy. He graduated college and knew everything there was to know about farming, and is, at least that's what he thought. And he came in, and we had name tags up above the where the cows stood in the barn. He goes, "What are those?" "Well, that's where the cows stand." "They know where they're supposed to stand?" It's like, "Well, yeah, they come in here twice a day, every day of their lives.
They know.
They will come right in, and when you get a new one, you know, she causes some issues, but for the most part, they know exactly where they're going to stand. I remember one of my jobs was going out and getting cattle, and for the most part, you could just stand at the back gate and rattle the chain, and they knew exactly what that was. So, you know, these animals are much, much smarter than we give them mm-hmm. credit for, and you know, the herds that I graze, it takes about 2 weeks before they understand my call. And I use the same call for all my herds, and I could probably march them right up into the studio here if I had a bucket of grain and I called them. I mean, they'd follow you anywhere. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about the, I wouldn't call it a beef operation, but you know, I think we had 17 or 18 head of steers at one point, and you know, that was much more than we could eat ourselves, but you know, we had the pasture to raise that, and so I wanted to talk a little bit about that, Dad.
Yeah, we sold some, you know. It was kind of you make a little money.
How do you sell your animals? How would you?
A lot of it was to family members, you know.
Oh, and, okay. But then there's like sale barns, right? There used to be sale barns in just about every town.
Yeah, we sold them that way. You know, you always run into a problem where you need a little money. It was nice. It was like a little savings account.
We did some bartering as well. You know, if we needed, I think we sold or traded a whole beef one year for a Alice Chalmers tractor.
And oh.
So it really did function as, you know, we weren't...
Barter system.
We weren't making a living doing it, but it gave me a reason to come home from college almost every weekend and help haul water and build fence. Mm-hmm. And
I was going to ask you about water. When you had that pasture and you said I had no water, no fences, and I think, well, what do you do about water? How do you solve that problem?
We hauled it.
we hauled it.
You have a big tank that you haul behind a tractor?
Eventually.
Okay.
But before, especially in the winter, because you can't just give them a bunch and then you're good for a couple of days. It's every single day. And we would haul it in
buckets.
Jugs in the 15-gallon jugs in the back of our truck and every single day.
Because, they got to have water. Yeah. They got to have water.
Yeah, that was kind of my introduction into the, you know, grazing on rented land, and that kind of that idea is when it really started to pop in my head of, you know, I don't need to own the land, I don't need to pay the taxes on it, I just need to have control of the land. And that, you know, I think we rented that pasture for like 10 years, and you know, we made much more money than we paid in rent on it, and we ate, I mean, I did not eat like a poor college kid in college. I think he might be just putting together how much hamburger and steaks I took out of the freezer when I came home on weekends. But, you know, we had some of the best beef that you can ask for, and once in a while we'd, you know, trade a quarter of a beef for a pig or something like that. And, you know, we ate very good. And
why did you have pigs, Brent? Where did they fit in?
For Dad, it was, I don't know, for income, basically. When we raised him, it was for the meat.
So you get a sow, you have her bred, you don't necessarily have a...
You don't have 9,000 of them.
Right. And then she'll have, you know, 2 litters a year, maybe? Is that true?
You can get more than that out of her.
And how many little piglets would she have?
Anywhere from 6 to 12, 14. Mm-hmm.
So then you raise them
and
then sell them for meat or for feeder pigs to somebody else?
Right.
Another thing here, and we'll address this after I do a little station break about specialization in the farming industry, but my name's Joseph Childs. You're listening to Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM radio from the Driftless area of western Wisconsin. You can find us online to find this episode and older ones at wdrt.org. And this show airs the last Saturday of every month. I'm sitting here with my father and a lifelong dairy farmer and grazer and Brent Childs and Philothea Beeson. And we're talking a little bit about the history of farming, how farming's changed, and talking about how younger people can get into farming. My next question, Philothea, you brought up the fact of, you know, having pigs and other animals on the farm, and you don't see, especially on larger scale farms, you don't see a whole lot of diversification, and large scale dairies, you don't even see many. You don't see them running their own tillable land either. So they often hire that out to someone who's doing custom work. Some large dairies just own the land where their buildings sit, and they buy everything in. So, you know, we've lost kind of the diversified small farm where you have some chickens that would eat your table scraps, and you'd have pigs that would eat table scraps and your treated milk. If you had a cow that you had to treat with antibiotics, you can't put that in the tank. So then it either goes to waste or you find a use for it. And one of those uses could be feeding bottle calves. One of them could be feeding some pigs. So just really trying to find a way to use everything that you have on the farm. You know, potato peelings and rotten tomatoes that you didn't quite pick out of the garden because you planted way too many for what you were going to use. And
that's what you do with all those tomatoes.
And your mom only wants to make, you know, maybe 100 jars of salsa, any more than that, and we're just going to give them to the chickens. But, you know, and we raised a garden, and that was a lot of small farms, quote-unquote, back in the day. That's what they did. They had multiple different species of both animals. Dad, you had mentioned growing oats. You know, try and find a field of oats now that isn't just a cover crop. It's pretty tough to find. So losing that diversification and really just specializing in one single thing, you know, maybe they say it's efficient because you only have to buy the machinery for that, but what happens when that market, you know, goes down? Then you can't really pivot.
I wanted to talk about markets a little bit because I'm not sure if people outside of farming really understand.
I don't think people inside farming really understand it.
I mean, sometimes your milk is selling high, sometimes it's selling unbelievably low, and there's nothing you can do about it. You have to sell your fluid milk because it's going to go bad. I mean, you have to sell it.
It's a perishable product.
It's perishable. Then you said your animals need to be fed, and they need to be fed every day. And if you run out of pasture, whatever, you got to buy your feed. But maybe because of the drought last year, hay is like three times as expensive as it usually is. And the farmer is just trying to balance all these things, what they're getting for their meat or their milk, what they're paying for feed and hay. It's a nightmare. And I was wondering if that's kind of where the Farm Bureau, National Farm regulations and everything come in to try to balance out,
protect the farmer
a little bit. But
there are tons and tons of players involved in it, between legislators, insurance salesmen, farmers, equipment dealers, seed dealers, chemical dealers, fertilizer. I mean, there are so many people involved in that, and that's why it is extremely difficult to enact changes in the farming regulation, is because if something is going to help 80% of the people, but there's 20% that are some big names and they can move their weight around in Washington and in Madison, that's not going to come down the pipeline. That change is going to get stopped. So it's an inherently convoluted situation when it comes to that. But it can really be boiled down, in my eyes, to supply and demand. That's, you know, we've created an artificial demand with subsidized products, and that gives a price floor and a guarantee of what you're going to make. And it's not a ton of money, but you're going to make some money, which it sounds good. But then you start to lose the products that aren't subsidized. So.
Explain the subsidized thing. Who's subsidizing what?
I want to put a caveat in front of this is that I am not an agronomist. I am not an economist, and I don't fully understand the intricacies of subsidies. What I understand it to be is that the government puts a price floor on a product. That if this product sells for less than this on the open market, so if Philothea is an open market buyer and Brent is an open market seller, he wants $5 for his corn, you want to give him $2 for the corn, and the government steps in and say, no, price floor is $3. I'll buy the corn from him at $3. So I put that price floor in, so then that makes open market buyers keep their price high, higher than the price floor. That's a very, very boiled down, simplified way to put it.
Good. I need it simple.
And that's it's a good thing, except that now you incentivize Brent, who is the open market, you know, the producer of the product. He's thinking, well, why would I produce sunflowers and grain, you know, like rye or oats or anything like that? Why would I produce that when there's no floor? So I'm at the mercy of the market.
Oh, the incentives then.
So then you get more and more people. You get more and more and more people producing the product. Well, what happens to the price when you have an overabundance of product or overabundance of supply? The price drops. So then the open market buyers are not going to pay any more, but the government will come in and say, no, we'll still pay this price floor. So there's really no incentive to say, well, I'm not making any money in corn this year. Why don't I produce a different product? And that's the same thing with milk. It's even more convoluted with the dairy industry. But in my eyes, there's a wild overabundance of milk production for what we actually need. And that's why prices are down so bad. And that's why farmers try to capture the economy of scale and just get bigger and bigger and bigger, because you can produce the milk for less if you have 5,000 cows than if you have 40. Because you have the same equipment. Your fixed costs are offset by your variable income. So it's, again, I'm not qualified to speak on this whatsoever, but that's my understanding of it.
Well, sometimes you hear an announcement on the radio and they'd say they're not buying any milk. Some dairies aren't buying milk anymore, and farmers are looking frantically around for places to sell their milk. I mean, this seems like a nightmare.
Well, we had John Latham on last month, and he's a dairy farmer. He had 850 head of cattle, and he was shipping his milk from Boscobel, Wisconsin, which is, you know, maybe an hour from the Illinois border, shipping it to northern Wisconsin, because that was where he could find someone that could accept his volume of milk, and he got a good price for.
Wow, so how did he get his milk there?
Semis. All semis. I mean, there was a nonstop train of semis leaving his farm to take his milk to northern Wisconsin. And that's where it used to be. You know, we live next to an old cheese factory in Mount Zion, and my parents live next to it. And that's been shut down for years. But the cheese factories that were in every single little town, you know, I lived in Excelsior for 5 years, and there used to be a cheese factory there. Every small town had a cheese factory to take that excess milk and make it into a non-perishable product. And that's just gone down with the concentration in the industry of there's less and less buyers, there's less and less producers, but they're producing the same amount of milk. So they're much larger farms.
I'm really learning a lot. I have a lot of questions. I just want to explain that, you know, I had this idea of doing a farming show, and then I met Joseph, and he's got the guests, and he's got a great, wonderful ability to interview people, and so we're trying to figure out, you know, where this show is going to go. We're definitely going to continue digging deep, and, you know, we'd love to have your input. I mean, are you listening? Would you care? We're thinking maybe it could be offered more often than once a month. I mean, there's plenty to talk about. And also, you know, we could trade off being interviewers or do it together, because I love this topic and I love interviewing people too. So that's why I'm sitting in here. But I'm really glad, Joseph, that you're really able to share this information in a way that we can understand.
I'm hoping it's accurate enough to not get me sued. But
well, now we realize what we would like to have on as guests. I mean, yeah, we'd like to understand a little bit more about the whole farm subsidy thing. And insurance, I had learned that, you know, certain crops qualify for insurance, but I learned the last show that food crops aren't insured. Like, if you're a vegetable farmer, you don't qualify for insurance, but if you raise soybeans that are going to be sold in China or something, you can be insured. And crop insurance is important, too. Like, if you have just a terrible failure, a drought, too much rain, flooding, high winds, all kinds of things. Or, you know, then you want to be able to get crop insurance. And
where it's important to have is in those instances. When it comes to, like, policy and stuff, and I've dipped my toe in the pool of talking with, you know, legislators and trying to affect some policy changes, and it is extremely difficult because you can sit and argue for half an hour on the language of changing one word in a policy, and it might not sound important, but it can change everything that policy means. And right now there's within both Farmers Union and Farm Bureau and legislation, in the legislators talking about how do we enact policy that is good for small farms but can't be exploited by large farms. And that is an age-old question of what is a small farm, what is a large farm. You know, that's mm-hmm. some people's idea of a small farm could be 600 head when all their neighbors are at 3,000. So, you know, how do we put in policies that can save the small farmers in bad years but can't be exploited by large farmers just to, you know, soak up those dollars that could be used to help others. But mm-hmm. that's a subject that we don't have enough time to explore.
Not today.
No.
But you can see that individual farmers just have no power. So they really need to join together. All these independent guys and gals.
And that was...
they need to join together somehow through organizations, right?
We have a rich, rich history of doing that. We have co-ops all over the place around Southwest Wisconsin. I think of, you know, my dad and my mom's generation of tobacco. That is such a rich history in this area, and the tobacco pools are why farmers were able to command a good price for their crop. And when they had a bad year, if milk prices were down or cattle prices were down, you know, they could depend on the tobacco crop to raise, you know, maybe an acre or two of tobacco, and that would pay the taxes and you could keep your farm. And, you know, you were raising your mm-hmm. own food, so you didn't have a whole lot of expenses outside of fuel and feed for your animals and taxes. And if you didn't pay your taxes, well, you're in trouble. So that tobacco pool, where it wasn't just, you know, one farmer coming there with a bundle of tobacco, it was, you know, 50 farmers in the area piling it all together. Well, now you've got some voice in the market because you can shop a larger amount of product around to really command and take some power within the industry and tell buyers, like, no, I don't want that price. I'm going to set this price, and if you want this much tobacco, you know, you're not just going to go buy it off of someone's farm for less. You have to deal with the larger mm-hmm. Coalition of farmers that came together with those tobacco pools.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a great topic to keep discussing in the future, especially policy and how individual farmers and communities can come together and get involved. And I'm not affiliated officially, but I'm part of the local farmers union, and that has been eye-opening for me just joining that. And it really has become a second family for me, a farming family, where I can talk with much more experienced farmers and get their ideas and soak in the knowledge and experience that they worked years and years and years to develop. So not just saying Farmers Union, but, you know, get involved in your community, get involved with local organizations, and find something that you're passionate about, and, you know, do some research on your own, and, you know, just find someone else that's passionate about it and start talking about it and having those conversations. And I think that's why I really enjoy hosting this show and bringing people on like my dad and John Latham and Dylan Bruce, is getting that conversation started. And so I think we're about to wrap up here. Just wanted to go over one more time. I've been Joseph Childs, sitting here with Philothea Beeson and my father, Brent Childs. This is Digging Deep on WDRT 91.9 FM, radio from the Driftless area of western Wisconsin. You can find this episode and many more online at WDRT.org. And this show will air every last Saturday of the month. Thank you very much for sitting in, Dad and Philothea, and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.